Welcome to the deep dive.
Today, we're going somewhere pretty dark.
Yeah, we're locking the doors for this one. We are focusing entirely on systems of intentional control.
We're looking at the protocols, the architectures, the hidden manuals designed to conceal or delete critical knowledge.
It's about peeling back what looks like reality to find the operational code running underneath it all.
And our sources today really force us to look at this from two angles.
Right. What are we working with?
On the one hand, we have this thematic index. Think of it like an abstract map. It charts these big concepts: erasure, forbidden tech, hidden governance, drawn from all these different narratives and files.
So these are like the rules of how to make things disappear.
Exactly. And on the other hand, we have a single, very real, and frankly, chilling case file.
Okay.
It details a hidden system that was operating in plain sight, perfect camouflage, in 1962, Louisiana.
So our mission here, for you listening, isn't just to hear these stories. It's to understand the boundaries, the lines between what you're allowed to know and what is being aggressively, systematically suppressed.
We have to look past the event itself, the secret, the disappearance, and really focus on the architecture.
How does a system get so good at deletion?
That's the question. We're examining the protocols that allow for the quiet consumption of information, and
Yeah.
that information could be a document, an artifact,
Or a person.
or a human life. The methods are universal, only the targets change.
Okay, let's start with that architecture then, with the index. These nine examples are our blueprints.
They're blueprints for how to make things vanish or how to control them while they're still right in front of you.
So where do we begin?
We begin with the idea of freezing time and using documentation as a weapon.
A weapon.
Yes. Our first source is the case of Real Wendy. It's from an asylum file about a child who, according to the record, never ages.
That's fascinating. It takes this huge cultural myth, Peter Pan, the boy who wouldn't grow up,
Right.
and it grounds it in this cold institutional setting, a medical file. So the theme here is erasure, but also arrested time.
Exactly. And the analysis shows how the document itself stops being a record of reality and becomes a mechanism for control.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if a person's life defies the expected path like aging, the system doesn't change the record to match reality.
It uses the record to freeze the person.
It freezes the subject. The file locks Real Wendy at one specific point in time forever.
So the paper reality just overwrites the physical one. The implication is huge. If the system is powerful enough, how do you ever escape that documented identity?
You might not. The analysis suggests the life either continues on as a kind of ghost identity, completely separate from the official record,
Work.
or the life is forcibly stopped to make it match the static record. This is how a myth gets weaponized into a tool.
A tool to conceal or just freeze a complicated truth.
It's the ultimate bureaucratic checkmate. The moment that file is stamped and closed, the subject's development is legally arrested. The callback nugget from the source says it all, really.
What's that?
As in Real Wendy, records can freeze while lives keep moving.
Chilling. Okay, so sticking with this idea of deletion, we move to Klaus Richter.
The erased soldier. He's linked to this highly classified S-87 bunker project, which the source calls Der Schatten, the Shadow.
So the theme here is pure black ops, deletion, war myth.
And Richter isn't just missing, he's a systematic non-person.
This forces us to completely reframe what success means in an operation, right? Normally, a deleted file is a failure, a mistake.
But not here. For a black op, especially one tied to something like the S-87 bunker, deleting a person from the record isn't a failure.
It's the highest achievement.
It's the absolute peak of operational security. You've achieved it when the asset Richter is completely untraceable, financially, legally, physically.
Every possible vector has to be wiped clean.
It's not just about getting rid of the body. You have to scrub the service record, the pay stubs, nullify the birth certificate. You create this iron wall of plausible deniability.
So the government can honestly say he never existed?
Because if they admit he existed, they admit the operation existed. And so the erasure itself becomes the evidence.
The absence of evidence is the proof.
For those who know how to look for it, yes. For those who can see the structural gaps in the archives, a perfect, clean absence means a protocol of institutional violence was carried out to hide something huge.
The negative space tells the story. So, what do you call that? The successful absence of evidence.
You call it proof of a protocol. The most secure information isn't what you have locked in a vault.
It's the information you successfully convinced the world never existed in the first place.
That's the core of it. Like close Richter, erasure becomes the evidence.
Okay, so from an erased person to an erased person with a powerful object.
You're right. The third piece here is about how forbidden technology can act as a kind of non-human witness, even when the person is gone.
This is the Luke Skywalker entry, but the source calls him Luang Saemung.
Luang Saemung, an orphan with a, quote, humming blade, who just vanishes from the historical record.
So the themes are familiar. Forbidden tech, prophecy, erasure. The person is gone, but the tool.
The tool remains, or at least the memory of it is too powerful to scrub. The analysis here is really clear. You can remove Luang Saemung from the books. A perfect Klaus Richter-level disappearance.
A bureaucratic success.
Complete success. But the technology he carried, that humming blade, it's an undeniable witness. It's too unique, too disruptive to be completely deleted from memory or from the archives.
So you can kill the messenger, but you can't kill the message if the message is a reality-altering piece of tech.
Exactly. It creates a paradox for whoever is trying to suppress the story. The fact that the humming blade existed proves the prophecy or the event was real no matter what the paper trail says.
The person is erased, but the concept they carried is too big to disappear.
It leaves a gravity well in history that people have to account for later. The blade itself hums the truth long after its owner has been silenced. The technology is the witness.
Okay, so that first section was all about successful erasure. Where does the index take us next?
Now we shift focus. We look at structures and environments, false fronts, that are designed not just to hide the truth, but to actively manipulate your behavior, to normalize control.
And we start with a really surprising one, monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
Or as the source calls it, the collector.
Yeah, and it's specifically about a basement board game that teaches debt.
This totally flips the idea of the game on its head.
Yeah.
I mean, we all think the point is to win, to buy Park Place.
That's the false front, the surface game. But the deeper theme, according to the source, is systemic obedience. It's social conditioning.
Conditioning for what?
The analysis says the goal isn't winning. The goal is to train the player in the brutal dynamics of debt, rent, and systemic risk before you ever have to face them in the real economy.
Wow. So it's a training protocol disguised as a game.
Look at the mechanics. The bank never runs out of money. The rules are absolute. You land on someone's property, you must pay. It conditions you to accept the inevitability of debt cycles.
And the idea that owning property is the only way to get ahead.
You're being trained in a low-stakes environment to be compliant when the real life-altering consequences of debt show up later. It's a highly efficient simulation of systemic control.
The game trained you before it pays you. That's unsettling.
It is. And that structural manipulation continues with the next entry, Aladdin or Adil Aldin.
Right. And this one focuses on the ledger he's trying to steal and this scapegoat twist.
The themes are false fronts, syndicates, and bait. The key insight here is that the operation is never about the visible prize.
The lamp, the ledger.
It's all just a lure. It's designed specifically to attract a certain kind of person.
A hero. Someone ambitious and disruptive, like Adil Aldin.
Exactly. The system needs someone to create a diversion. While the hero is fighting guards and navigating traps to get the visible prize.
The real operation, the real transfer of power, is happening quietly in the background.
And the person reaching for that ledger, for that lamp, has been pre-selected from the very beginning to be the scapegoat.
So he set up to take the fall.
The system needs someone visible to blame when the hidden transaction is done. The scandal of the hero's quest covers the quiet crime of the syndicate.
So Aladdin takes the blame for all the commotion, the syndicate gets away with the real prize, and no one is the wiser.
The treasure is always a trap. And the hero is precast as the fall guy. It's a system that requires a sacrifice to keep the real power structure hidden.
Wow. Okay, from stories and games to a real world place, Disney World.
The Disney World controlled zone, a perfect real world example of governance through technicality and simulation.
This has to be the ultimate example of control hiding in plain sight.
It is. The spectacle is the camouflage. You're so focused on the magic, the simulated happiness, that you completely miss the internal laws and protocols that are actually governing the territory.
And the source points to the 99-foot tower rule.
That's the key detail. Why that exact number, 199 feet?
I have no idea.
It's about regulatory thresholds.
Yeah.
The FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, mandates that any structure 200 feet or taller requires specific permits, flashing lights, public disclosures.
So by staying at 199 feet.
They stay just under the radar of federal scrutiny. They aren't breaking the law. They are meticulously operating just beneath it.
It's control through loopholes.
Precise numerical manipulation. You're watching the fireworks, but the real control is happening in the fine print of the building code. It shows you that the greatest autonomy isn't achieved by fighting the law, but by navigating its technicalities perfectly.
As in Disney World, control hides best in plain sight.
That's it.
So if these systems are so good at hiding the protocol or erasing the person, what's left behind? What's the evidence?
That brings us to our last two examples from the index, the lingering witnesses, the physical traces left behind by devotion or delusion.
First up is Buzz Lightyear.
Oh.
Or the case file of Russell Kearney.
Right. And his DIY hyperflight launch, all driven by that phrase, to infinity.
The themes here are devotion, DIY tech, and desert myth.
This is about how an intense, almost religious belief can manifest as a physical object. Russell Kearney was so devoted to the idea of hyperflight that he built these crude, dangerous machines.
And the machines outlive him.
The object outlives the maker. The attempt fails. The belief might collapse, but the artifact survives. It becomes this silent testament to the extremity of that belief.
The source mentions these things being found in the desert.
Yes, abandoned artifacts in remote places. They're the material ghosts of an idea that was too powerful for the person who had it. Echoing Buzz Lightyear, artifacts outlive their makers.
And the final entry in the index.
It's the case of real-life Mario, a man named Marco Bellini. The file documents his descent into a sewer system, and it ends with his final chilling message.
Which was?
I found the boss fight.
Oof. So the themes here are delusion, urban myth, and spores.
The spores are critical. The analysis isn't about whether he found the boss fight. It's about the environmental and psychological transformation that happens while you're chasing the myth.
So chasing the castle, the secret level.
Yeah.
It changes you before you even get there.
Physically and psychologically. The source is specific about the environment itself changing the trespasser. Inhaling mold, spores, exposure to chemicals in the runoff.
Marco Bellini is being physically transformed by the system he's trying to conquer.
He's being assimilated by it. The delusion drives him deeper, but the environment ensures that by the time he reaches his goal, he's no longer the person who started the journey.
The player changes first.
The system demands you assimilate before it grants you access. Like Mario, chasing the castle changes the player first.
Okay, we've just unpacked this entire index, this architecture of erasure and control.
We have, and now we shift from the abstract to the terrifyingly real.
We're moving to the deep dive case file.
Yes, this is where we see all those principles. Consistency as camouflage, operational security, erasure as evidence applied with absolute visceral precision.
This is the diner.
This is the diner that asked men one question.
Okay, let's set the scene precisely.
Tula, Louisiana, 1962. The location was everything. It was a small roadside diner about 20 meters from the nearest town.
That distance is important.
It's critical, far enough for privacy, for isolation, but close enough to seem like a normal part of the local economy, an anomaly hiding in the routine.
And the operator.
A woman named Evelyn Crow. She was the perfect facade. The sources describe her as the definition of consistency. Quiet, polite, reliable.
She was trusted.
Locally trusted. And she was famous for one thing in particular. Her house-made breakfast sausages, served every single morning.
And that consistency. That was the foundation of the whole protocol.
It was everything. If a system is perfectly, relentlessly consistent, its output becomes trusted. No one questions the routine.
They depend on it. That sausage was the final delivered product of a hidden protocol.
A protocol that targeted a very specific group.
Men traveling alone.
Right. Truck drivers, oil workers, salesmen. Transient, isolated men whose disappearance could be easily explained away.
He just moved on.
Or he ran into trouble on the road. Isolation was the precondition for a successful, untraceable erasure.
And the operational security for this whole thing?
Yeah.
Came down to a single question.
A single, precise, non-threatening question she would ask male customers while taking their dinner order.
Delivered in a friendly, conversational tone.
Does anyone know you're stopping here tonight?
And that's it. That's the failsafe.
That's the entire risk assessment. It instantly determines the target's isolation level. If he says, yeah, my wife knows, or my dispatcher has my route.
The risk is too high.
The risk is too high. He gets his meal, he pays his check, and he's sent on his way. The system prioritizes its own integrity over any single opportunity.
But if the answer is no.
If the answer is no, the system can proceed with maximum confidence toward total untraceable deletion.
This quiet, perfect system ran for. We don't even know how long.
Possibly for years, until November 1962, when an external variable, something the protocol couldn't account for, broke the pattern.
Proximity.
proximity, and a man named Harold Knox.
A pipeline inspector. He wasn't a target.
No, but his truck broke down right there on that stretch of highway. It forced him to stop at the diner.
And he did something that broke the system's rules.
He signed the guest book.
Creating a paper trail.
A direct link between him and that location. A piece of evidence the protocol would normally have destroyed. Then he rented the small room behind the kitchen.
And the system activated that night.
As planned, consistent with its parameters. But Harold Knox, he didn't follow the script.
He woke up.
He woke up. And the source is very specific. He woke to the sound of someone breathing.
Oh, that's chilling.
Close. In the room with him, he sees a figure near the doorway, holding something heavy.
This is the moment the protocol fails. It relied on the target being incapacitated.
On silence. On speed. When Knox reached for the lamp to turn on the light, the figure rushed him to complete the erasure.
But he got away.
A desperate, successful escape through a side window. He ran out into the night and made it to the highway. He became the living witness.
The artifact that survived the protocol.
He was the system's one failure to achieve total deletion. And his testimony was about to bring the whole thing crashing down.
So Knox escapes. He gets help. The deputies arrive.
And they question Evelyn Crowe.
In her response.
Is a masterclass in chilling professionalism. She doesn't lie. She doesn't deny it. She doesn't try to run.
What did she say when they asked her about being in his room?
She was calm, definitive. She just said, they don't usually wake up.
Wow.
It's not an admission of guilt. It's an operational debrief. She's just stating a fact. This was a statistical anomaly to her, not a moral failure.
And that statement, they don't usually wake up, that triggers the full search.
Immediately. And the evidence of the protocol's output starts to materialize very, very quickly.
Behind the diner.
They find several shallow burial sites. And crucially, the report notes that the remains are incomplete.
Which links directly back to the diner's product. The burial was just disposal of the residue.
Exactly. But the final damning piece of evidence was inside a smokehouse nearby.
What do they find?
Sealed packages of cured meat. And the official investigator's description of the product
was uncomfortably familiar.
Uncomfortably familiar. Because the system's camouflage was so perfect, it was a trusted, house-made product being served to the community.
The protocol was now totally exposed. Selection, deletion, processing, and consumption.
And then came the scientific proof. State testing confirmed the tissue in the smokehouse didn't match any livestock from the region. It was undeniable. The product was linked back to the victims.
And what happens next is the final erasure.
A final institutional erasure. The state steps in. By official mandate, all the packages of cured meat are removed from evidence.
And destroyed.
Immediately destroyed by incineration. The physical proof of the system's product was deleted from the public record to prevent panic, to prevent traceability.
It was scrubbed.
And the final tally confirmed everything. Every missing person case later linked to that diner was male. The diner was closed that same day. The system was exposed, but its most damning product was successfully and prominently removed from public view.
So we've come full circle from the architectural index to this horrifyingly precise real-world application.
Evelyn Crowe's diner is the perfect synthesis. She used a consistent system, the routine, the question, to achieve absolute erasure.
Evidenced by the incomplete remains and then the state's destruction of the final product.
And Harold Knox was the single surviving artifact that allowed us to witness the hidden protocol at all.
The core insight here, it really does connect back to everything we talked about. The Disney World protocol, the monopoly conditioning.
The most efficient systems of control, the darkest secrets, they don't hide in some locked bunker.
They operate right out in the open, under the scrutiny of routine. They use consistency as camouflage.
And that thing that feels uncomfortably familiar, that's often the truth, hiding in plain sight.
We've talked about how artifacts like the Humming Blade or the DIY rockets outlive their makers.
And how the very act of erasure becomes its own form of evidence. We've seen how a system can turn a person into a disposable lure or freeze their life in a file.
So for you, listen to this. If a system can be so consistent, so quiet, that its output becomes a trusted, house-made product that you consume without a second thought,
then what routine, familiar element in your own daily life might actually be the finished artifact from a protocol you never even saw running?
You might just be standing in the collector's basement playing the game.
And realizing the treasure was a trap built just for you.